My name is Kelly Maloney, and I am a research scientist with CERES, the cooperative institute between NOAA and the University of Colorado.
Kelly, what's your expertise there?
I study extreme precipitation, both on kind of weather timescale, short-term type of events, and then also within the framework of a changing climate.
What are your initial impressions of this storm? Now, you actually live in Boulder. You live in South Boulder.
I live in South Boulder, I'm actually standing at my window watching my husband dig more ditches in the backyard to keep water out of our basement. So, yeah, it's been certainly a personal impact, of course, too.
And from a professional perspective, what do you think of this storm?
Yeah, this is absolutely an incredible event from a meteorological standpoint. I came out to Boulder about 4 years ago to do a postdoc study on front range extreme events. And so, I had read all of the background literature about this area being flood prone and knew the statistics, but I think this event has surprised a lot of experts in the field just because it has obviously been such a high impact event, but it has occurred in a meteorological setting that none of us kind of envisioned before. This doesn't quite map to the extreme events of the past that we always point to, like the Big Thompson Canyon flood and the Fort Collins flood. So aside from the sheer impact of rain being completely incredible and record setting, the way in which it's unfolded has been really fascinating and has opened up a huge number of questions for us to start studying.
Are there any historical precedents for this in Colorado?
Like I said, the big storms that we usually point to look pretty dissimilar to this. And so we do know that we get intense rainfall. Again, those big headline-making storms like the Big Thompson flood and the Fort Collins flood of 1997, they, were high impact and incredible in their own right, but the historical precedence in terms of days of rainfall doesn't usually look like this. And when we tend to see days of heavy precipitation, it usually doesn't happen in September. So this is all kind of throwing, meteorologists and climate scientists for a loop a little bit, just in terms of both the type of event and the timing in terms of the seasonality of it. There's not, at least that I know of, a great historical precedent for it.
Yeah, this is a completely understandable storm from a meteorological perspective, isn't it? And if so, tell us a little bit about this kind of perfect storm.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything adds up when you go back and you look at the data. You saw that, after a couple of weeks of incredibly warm and dry conditions, we were in a steady stream of moisture coming up out of the tropics, so kind of a little bit out of the Gulf of Mexico and some out of the Pacific, in that traditional monsoon flow. So we were getting a lot of moisture, and then once we had one of these upper lows that a lot of us kind of look to give us wintertime snowstorms, that swung into place. And so all of a sudden, you had a ton of moisture sitting here in the Front Range, and then that upslope flow. So you had rising air and all of that moisture. And so those pieces very much add up to the type of rainfall that we've seen. Again, the difference is that usually that pattern and that sheer amount of moisture doesn't lock in place for days on end.
And what caused it to lock in place?
It's a slow moving kind of large scale pattern. So, we had one system, a ridge sort of shift off to the east and then a low sort of build in, and then they both became locked essentially and didn't really do much moving. And so that's a question that is out of my area of expertise, but certainly one that is critical to understanding both this event in its own right and then how it does fall within past and future climate possibilities, because it is that sort of blocking, atmospheric blocking, slow-moving weather system type of setup that kind of makes you go beyond, say, a day of heavy rainfall into days of very heavy rainfall that is, catastrophic and not just a little bit of a soggy pattern.
Well, and respecting all of our limits of knowledge, I'd like to sort of talk now about the climate change sort of connection. I think our listeners now are pretty familiar with the concept that a single event is not indicative of climate change in general. But would you go ahead and refresh our memories on that particular point?
Sure, yeah. Right, so absolutely. As even as the best climate scientists that live here in Boulder will tell you, you can't take a single event and describe it to climate change. The very best you can do is do a fairly long and in-depth study and try and attribute certain pieces of an event that may or may not have been, you know, helped out by climate warming. So, you know, until we can get to that point, again, those kinds of studies take a long time to do. You know, ahead of that, you can kind of step back and say the big picture that we know, that we think we know from a lot, many, many studies over the last couple of decades even, do point to a consistent pattern of the increase of extreme precipitation events. You know, as the climate warms on a global scale, you can say that in general terms, the atmosphere can hold more water. And so that if a storm is in place at the right time, you know, right place, then you can tap into that extra moisture. And so the atmosphere is sort of primed and in a good position to dump a little bit more. So on a very, you know, broad brush, from a very, you know, large, big picture perspective, that makes sense. You know, then you start to get into the details of, well, how does that look for a specific event like this? And then you start to get into all of those questions of, well, why was the air in place at that time? Why did it not change? Why did that large-scale pattern not shift? And so those questions start to get a lot trickier much faster. So, again, a lot of people can say, well, this is consistent with global climate change, but in terms of actually saying it's caused by, we're certainly nowhere close to being able to make that sort of claim.
Well, let's do try to drill down just a little bit geographically and temporally to mm-hmm. not this particular storm, but the sort of future possibilities that we might see in the Front Range. Some places in the world are going to become drier and some places are going to become wetter. What do we understand based on current climate modeling about what might mm-hmm. happen in the Central Front Range?
Yeah, the Central Front Range is a pretty unique place in its own right. We feel like we have a pretty good handle on the trends that we might expect across the eastern half or two-thirds of the country and also in the southwest. So in the eastern part of the country, we do expect things to get a little more moist, you know, an increase in a lot of average rainfall in a lot of places, and the complete opposite in the desert southwest. When you look at average precipitation, we expect to see it drying. So that places the Colorado Front Range in the unique position of being right in between those two climate signals. And so when you look at a lot of studies, we fall into a gray area, and people kind of say, well, it's still a bit of a coin toss in terms of the mean pattern. So then we drill down deeper, and we say, well, what, you know, what more can we say about specific weather patterns? And that's kind of where the science is now. You know, kind of people like myself who focus on small scale parts of the, you know, weather events and parts of the climate, we're looking at things like, is there still going to be, you know, ample moisture and forcing for these small scale summertime extreme storms? And the answer is absolutely yes. There's no reason that those types of events will decrease or go away. Now the question is to whether they increase in frequency or intensity. That falls kind of back to that larger scale question of how does our monsoon pattern change? How do these large scale systems end up changing? And again, that's very much in a gray area. So, you know, that's kind of just the state of the science for the Colorado Front Range. I think most folks would say at this point we feel like the region will see a mean drying, so kind of longer stretches of dry punctuated by, you know, an increase in extremes, but it's still definitely an area of study. Lots of people are continuing to look into this.
And the impacts can be felt on a very, very local level or even a micro level, and not just in a microclimate sense, you know, this bit of ground is shaded by this tree, but in the sense of, for example, I recall a study that said that that we might actually have more snowpack at the higher elevations, and mm-hmm. I'm trying to recall that study. If you happen to remember it, kind of elaborate on that a little bit, and in the sense of this is a this the very kind of fine details can really alter the picture of what's going on.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the studies you're probably referring to is a study that was done at NCAR in the last couple of years. It was a study focusing on the Colorado Headwaters region, where they found that the snow level might move up, and so some folks might see a decrease, but the snowpack may increase very well to at high elevations. And so when you start to look at the impacts of the hydrology and the long-term hydrology, and you know everything in Colorado is snowpack-driven in terms of our surface-based background water, it does start to impact these extreme events. Now, something interesting about this case is that we're obviously not really dealing with snowpack issues, but a lot of folks are comparing this event to the event in the late 1800s that kind of wiped out Boulder. And the difference there is that there was much, much, much less precipitation that actually fell in that event, but it was a snow melt-driven event. And so you're absolutely right in terms of the impact of being very, very dependent on what the snowpack looks like that year, what the surface hydrology looks like that year. And in terms of that microscale aspect that you mentioned, it's very different now, too, even just within the last couple of decades in terms of our developed areas, which areas are paved and have been urbanized. So places like Longmont and areas east of here that maybe haven't seen large impacts in the past are experiencing very different types of impacts now because the hydrology is so different. The ground soaks things up differently. And so we're all kind of learning a lot about what kinds of rain and where that rain falls, how it affects people downstream. So it's incredibly complex and obviously interesting from a scientific perspective, but very humbling as well to continue to be surprised in this event when and where, the biggest impacts continue to be felt.
When I look at, when you said that about the late 19th century, I'm recalling photographs of Boulder that the hills were just denuded. Probably because of taking of timber for building and mining and things like that. So that must have played a part too.
Right. And so, we have an analogy. We obviously don't do that anymore. We protect our resources here in town and in the Front Range. But, the analogy then is to the burn areas from last summer or from the last couple of seasons, the Four Mile Canyon area. Obviously, everyone's been watching how all the burn scar areas will react to this, and that's where we've seen a lot of the problems. Indeed, is there is a lack of vegetation there to help slow things down. So, the causes differ between decades and centuries, but the impacts respond in much the same way. But understanding them in hindsight and predicting them ahead of time are obviously two different things.
Can you explain what the fog of prediction is, and is this going to be an issue? Are we ever going to be able to truly understand until it happens what is going to happen in the future with climate and with the weather patterns in the Central Front Range?
I think that to say that we'll never get there is pretty pessimistic, but I think there are certainly limitations to being able to put those pictures together. A lot of what we understand about climate, the work is done in a very different framework as what we understand about weather and predictability. So every year, the National Weather Service and the national centers make great strides in our prediction of these actual events. Now, linking those events to what we understand about climate change is an area that lots of people are working on, but it's a fairly new area, really trying to combine the interface of weather and climate. So in a lot of ways, that's the challenge. On the other side, climate scientists continue to make, great strides in understanding large-scale trends, but again, applying a trend to a specific weather event, that is kind of that fog and that gray area. And so I think we're getting a lot better at connecting those things and making, bridging the gap between the climate and weather predictability, but it'll take time. We have challenges in predicting things 5 days out, much less, 5 decades out. So it'll be a matter of climate scientists and weather scientists and social scientists really working together to understand how to make the most out of what information we're most confident in. So I anticipate we'll make great leaps and bounds in the next, 5 to 10 years even. But, the expectation should remain realistic. There's still going to be uncertainty involved. It's a chaotic system we're dealing with.
Is this storm going to change your research direction, the research direction of your colleagues?
I think luckily for me, what I was studying very much falls in line with this kind of event, but it absolutely will change, I think, some of the directions in which I take things in the future. My particular work, I deal with a lot of decision makers and water resources managers and people who are really concerned about what the most rain is that we can ever expect in this area, because they want to build things to be safe and protect life and property. And so an event like this really starts to challenge your notion of, what are you comfortable saying the upper limit of something is. So again, kind of going back to the things I mentioned before, this happened during a time of the year that we don't expect to see it. It happened from a weather pattern perspective that we don't expect to see it in. So we will, I think both myself and others, really start to reevaluate the big picture here and how you frame your studies and what you work on. And then, of course, many people will be studying this event just in terms of picking it apart and understanding it better, and then placing it within the framework of both weather and climate. So I think we'll see this event certainly better understood as we go forward, but also serving as a means for people to move the whole field along. So, yeah, I think it'll definitely have an impact in folks' research directions.
Now, my next question has to do with your interaction with policymakers and with planners. This storm is going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and it has already cost lives. Planners and officials are going to want to know what they can do to protect themselves, and yet there is a money issue too. In your dealings mm-hmm. with policymakers and planners, is there a sense of frustration on both sides that the science can't meet the planning expectations, and how is that problem attacked?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very challenging question, both for the scientists and the policymakers. And I think we enjoy working together because it's a challenge that's worth taking on. The way things work now is that the policymakers, the water resources managers, the decision makers, they have a framework that it's risk-based. And so they have a lot of tools at their disposal to just compute things in terms of human life risk, economic risk. And so things come together in a way that they've used for decades. And now that they are trying to incorporate climate scientists or climate science and improve weather science, It is hard to kind of take a step beyond where things are now and where they hope things will be, because, as I said, us weather folks, we are used to dealing with an uncertain system, but when you have to make a decision at the end of the day, you need things to be fairly certain. And so we go back and forth. It's a game of we do research, we come up with results, we test them, we try and ascribe a certainty level to them, and sometimes that level of certainty meets the needs, meets the requirement, and things will change, and other times it requires more testing. So it's very much sometimes a game of one step forward, two steps back, and you iterate on things, but it's not a black and white or easy process for sure.
Yeah. Now, are you going to be approached by planners in the city, in the county, in the state, in the next few years, asking for specific recommendations, and how will you address those kind of very specific recommendations in the next few years?
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see what we can do with this. I've already started talking to a couple of folks that I work with on Front Range issues, again, water resources folks, and we've already started talking about we really need to use this event in order to go back and re-examine, well, what kind of rules are you using now? How would this event, compare to those rules? And so we will be looking at very specific criteria. Again, going back to that issue of we would never expect something like this to happen in September traditionally or from this kind of duration. And so going back and looking at those old tables and procedures and rules, we'll really get into those specific details. Now, the rest of it kind of in terms of who acts on that and who does that, Boulder County, the city of Boulder, tends to be a pretty progressive community in terms of welcoming new science. So we'll see who gets approached and who does that work. But we certainly anticipate at NOAA and the University of Colorado, the relationship that we have with the Water Resources Managers, they've already been in touch about this event and want to use it to, you know, update their planning as needed. Of course, there's going to be lots of study that has to happen ahead of that, but we're already looking at it even as the rain continues to fall as part of this event.
You mentioned at the top of the interview that your husband is out in the backyard digging some ditches. For all your knowledge and understanding and contacts in this area, it really does still sometimes come down to the spade, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been unreal to kind of stare at a computer and think that you're somewhat removed from it. You're just looking at data and then go out and try and get in your car and realize the road at the end of the street is covered in water and oh yeah, you're actually in the middle of this. You're actually living it. So again, it's incredible and exciting in a way, but also incredibly humbling and of course sad too as we learn of all of the impacts. So it's quite a roller coaster these past few days.
Kelly Mahoney, Dr. Kelly Mahoney with Ceres, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.